Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we take a trip off the main highway and a detour into the back alleys and some of the increasingly mean streets in central Wisconsin. Today we're going to travel past family-owned drugstores that will no longer dispense prescriptions for pain medicine because they have been targeted by brazen armed robbers holding up store clerks at gunpoint in broad daylight to make off with a cache of Vicodin, Oxycontin, and other pharmaceutical narcotics. We're going to stop by the basements and backlot trailers where amateur chemists mix dangerous substances together to produce methamphetamine. Uncaring of the deadliness of the product they're producing, and even for the safety of their own children living inside their explosive homemade laboratories. Today, our guests are two local detectives who are fighting an uphill battle to bust the dealers and manufacturers and find the addicts who are creating the demand, filling our jails and clogging our criminal justice system. David Forsyth is a special agent in charge with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Matt Barnes is a detective with the Wausau Police Department. And as always, our lines are open for your phone calls at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. Use that toll-free line if you're outside of the Wausau area, 1-800-780-9742. Dave Forsyth and Matt Barnes, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
How big of a problem is OxyContin and other prescription narcotics? And I'll ask you that, Matt. And how much of your time does it take as a detective?
That's a tough question to answer, how much of a problem this is to our community, and I can speak specifically to Wausau. You know, on the worst case scenario, we deal with multiple deaths every year from overdose as far as taking prescribed and illicit narcotics. So we're dealing with people that are dying before they should be. From a criminal standpoint, those deaths are crimes because someone's providing those individuals with those medications, which are causing their death. We mm-hmm. have robberies. In the last year, we've had numerous robberies, a crime that we never saw much of in Wausau, and they're directly resulted to narcotic abuse. And by narcotics, you had mentioned it earlier, we're talking about opiates and synthetic opiates, which include OxyContin, morphine, Vicodin, and there's probably 50, 60 others.
And how bad is it now compared to, say, 10 or 20 years ago in central Wisconsin?
Well, I was in high school 20 years ago in central Wisconsin, and it wasn't something I even knew about at that time. I've been in law enforcement for a little over 8 years, and it wasn't a problem that I recognized early in my law enforcement career. If you had asked me 3 years ago whether we'd have three or four pharmacies robbed in the Wausau area within a three-month period of time, I would have said no.
Now, you call OxyContin a narcotic, and for most people, when they think of a narcotic, they're thinking of things like heroin or morphine. Explain that.
A narcotic, and I'll use it as describing it as a narcotic analgesic, and that is a medication that's an opiate, so opium coming from a poppy plant, or a synthetic opiate. Now, to be an opiate or a narcotic, you have to do a couple things. One, it has to cure pain, stop pain. Two, it has withdrawal symptoms when taken for a period of time and then stopped. And three, any narcotic will relieve the withdrawal symptoms of any other narcotic. To say that if I have an OxyContin addiction, and I've taken OxyContin and abused it every day for the last year, and I can't get OxyContin, I could use Vicodin or heroin or morphine to relieve my withdrawal symptoms from OxyContin.
So to a certain extent, these substances are interchangeable with the way that they affect the human body.
Correct. As a matter of fact, you know, in the news releases that have been out, OxyContin is almost being used generically to describe numerous different pharmaceutical narcotics.
And Dave Forsyth, you were telling us before we went on the air that you just got back from a group of other people who are dealing with this problem downstate. Tell us what's happening in the Milwaukee area.
Well, in Milwaukee, and first I'll start with from a statewide perspective. I was at a Attorney General conference probably close to a year ago, and there was basically people from all 72 countries, counties of the state that were there, and they specifically said that their major emerging threat as far as drugs was OxyContin and other prescription drugs. I was talking to a counterpart of mine down in Milwaukee earlier today, and he said that what they're seeing a lot down in the Milwaukee area is late teens, early 20s, people that are starting on OxyContin and becoming addicted, and then they're not able to get their prescriptions filled, and they're getting it on the street. It gets to be too much money because it's going for close to a dollar a milligram, and some of them it's up to an 80-milligram pill. And what they're doing is switching over and getting heroin, you know, $10 bags of heroin, and some of the purity levels, you know, it's not made in a laboratory, obviously, so all of a sudden they're getting 20% purity level. Later they get 65, 70% purity level. They're shooting up, however they're taking it with needles or whatever it might be, and they've had several overdoses specifically that fit that criteria with those age groups and stuff.
You were telling me about one specific case of a guy who was driving.
Yeah, driving, obviously heavily addicted, and basically driving along, comes to a stop sign and uses a needle and shoots the heroin up through his gums in his mouth, and it was way too pure, and he ended up passing out and dying right there. The police found him in his vehicle
behind the
wheel, needle still stuck in his mouth. Yeah,
amazing, just amazing. And you were mentioning that the OxyContin, it takes what, an 80 milligram dose, and it's going for how much milligram?
Well, the doses can come in many different varieties. You can have,
but on the street, how much does it cost per milligram for an OxyContin pill?
A dollar in Central Wisconsin.
A dollar. So for one 80 milligram pill, you're paying $80 for that one pill.
That's correct.
Which is why people who are addicted start buying heroin instead, because it's cheaper.
Sure.
Dave Forsyth, he's a special agent in charge with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Matt Barnes, a detective with the Wausau Police Department. We're talking about OxyContin, methamphetamines, and other drugs that are causing a lot of problems in our communities these days and what we can do about it. If you've got a story you'd like to tell, if you know somebody who's faced the problems of addiction, if you've got questions about what you can do to keep your kids safe, if you've got questions about how this is affecting crime in our area, how it's affecting family-owned drugstores who are no longer even dispensing these substances, give us a call, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742, 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, formerly Fiserv Health, providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Our guests in our Wausau studios, Dave Forsyth, who is an agent in charge with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and Matt Barnes, a detective with the Wausau Police Department. We're talking about OxyContin, methamphetamines, and other drug abuse problems. We'll get to methamphetamine in a minute, but Matt Barnes, I want to continue on OxyContin right now, because you mentioned something that is something that we haven't had to deal with in Central Wisconsin, and that's these brazen daylight robberies in the middle of the day, people holding up drugstores and making off with Vicodin and OxyContin and other prescription narcotics.
Correct. It's new to our area for pharmacy robberies. But it's a clue to us to tell us how big the problem has become. And investigating those armed robberies, we really got an education in what's really taking place. It tells us that there's a huge demand. I would have never guessed that it was a dollar a milligram, that one pill was $80 prior to the first robbery of Young's drugstore. Once we started executing search warrants on potential suspects and interviewing those people and learning how much it was worth, there's two reasons to rob a pharmacy to take those drugs. One is to resell that pill or tablet for a profit, or your addiction is so strong that you have no other choice to feed that addiction other than to commit that crime.
Now, with that kind of a price on the undercover agents, undercover market, do you find that people who have legitimate prescriptions for these drugs are sometimes just selling them in order to pocket the profit that they can make?
Absolutely. You know, there are people stealing from family members. There are, we've had cases with people working in the healthcare industry stealing from patients to turn around and sell those drugs or take those drugs. They're available. I would tell the average listener to go open your medicine cabinet and see what you have in there. Most people don't take, you know, for example, I know myself, I've been prescribed a Vicodin, for example, and if I'm not in pain, I don't take the medication, and, mm-hmm. and then it sits in a cabinet. And, you know, it's a scenario like that where someone can come in and take that medication, or a child can take that medication from their parents, that helps even start these addictions.
So if you've got a prescription for something like Vicodin, you haven't used all the pills, and you've got kids in the house, you should probably get rid of that prescription.
Oh, I believe you should, just to, or make sure that those type of medications, depending on how old your children are and how available they are locked up someplace safe.
Dave Forsyth, are we seeing robberies in the rest of Wisconsin like we've seen in central Wisconsin, people trying to get prescription narcotics?
We are. Because I live in this area, obviously that hit really close to home too, specifically the Wausau ones.
You get the feeling that it can't happen here, yeah. And then you're just really surprised in a bad way to find out that it can.
I think sadly we're getting not so naive around this area. I was talking to somebody else earlier today also in a state west of us that specifically they had their bank robbery detail. The bank robberies were going way down, and the pharmacy robberies were going way up, so those detectives assigned to the bank robbery detail were now basically a task force working pharmacy burglaries, the vast majority of which was for OxyContin.
2616371, 2616371, or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51. We're talking about drug abuse in central Wisconsin with Dave Forsyth and Matt Barnes. Matt, tell us about one specific case, and I think we can do that. His image has been on the cover of City Pages in the last couple of weeks. Mitch Schmelzer, tell us about that case.
Well, and I think this is a great way to discuss that there are lots of different type of drug users out there. There are people that want the euphoria and want the high and maybe smoke marijuana or use cocaine or methamphetamine. You know, I guess the slang, they're dopers. They're people that want to be high. And then there's the opposite of that, and that's where narcotics and OxyContin and Vicodin come into play, where that drug use really spans the socioeconomic level in society, meaning you can find people that live in a $1 million house and you can find people that live in a trailer park all having the same addiction because of how a lot of people's addictions begin. In Mitch Schmelzer's case, by his own admission in the paper, here's an individual that suffered an injury, was prescribed a narcotic, and his addiction grew out of having pain, being prescribed that medication. And then what people find is they have this addiction, but you're not going to get a permanent prescription for a narcotic from a doctor. So all of a sudden that prescription is gone, and you're left either doctor-seeking or creating fraudulent prescriptions for the pharmacy, or buying it illicitly on the street. And if your dealer doesn't have the medication you need and you're going to go into withdrawal and you can't handle that, you're left with very few options.
Now, Mitch was a respected member of the community. Tell us about his background. He was working as a nurse.
He was. He was a nurse at several different places. And according to that newspaper article, he recognized that he had a problem and made several attempts at different rehab facilities to address his addiction.
And he was working at a number of hospitals. He was working at another clinic up in the Merrill area. He got into problems a number of times and went into rehab, and somehow he kept relapsing. Sometimes he was clean for up to a year.
Correct. And I think that's a common trend you'll hear with if you ever have the opportunity to interview a bunch of people that are addicted to different medications. That's a lifelong battle. If you talk to alcoholics who who haven't had a drink for 10 years, are you still an alcoholic? Well, if you start drinking again, you're going to be, and there's always that want for that. And it there may be highs, there may be lows with that, but you definitely see relapses with the addiction.
So how did Mitch Schmelzer, respected member of the community, a licensed nurse, a guy who's working on the staffs of hospitals and medical clinics in North Central Wisconsin, how did he end up in the Marathon County Jail charged with armed robbery?
Well, I think the beginning of the end for Mitch was losing his license or surrendering his license to practice as a nurse, which he did, and then got another job in the food and beverage industry and was respected and did well in that. But throughout this process, continued to abuse, because of that addiction, different narcotic medications. And the withdrawal from narcotic is horrible. You're violently ill, and it takes days. It peaks 3-4 days out if you don't have that medication. And my understanding from talking to people who are narcotic addicted that have been through withdrawal, they want to die. They will do anything to get that medication. And I think that's what happened to Mitch. He needed that medication and didn't have any way to get it that day.
And according to the City Pages article, he was planning on doing some hunting. So he had a shotgun in his truck, and he was driving by Young's Drugstore in Wausau. What happened next?
He took the 12-gauge shotgun out of his truck. He took a messenger-style bag because he didn't have a mask, and kind of put that over his head, went inside, and at gunpoint demanded narcotic medication from the pharmacy, which they gave him, and he got back in his truck and left.
And that wasn't a very carefully planned incident of crime, because he was arrested about 6 hours later.
And in that case, we were lucky enough to have eyewitnesses that got enough of the license plate to provide us with, to narrow that down enough that the State Patrol, I believe, started running who the possibilities with that plate, got an address in Merrill. Merrill police officers did a fantastic job. They identified the truck, saw it pull into the garage, made contact, saw some of the evidence, and we executed a search warrant at his residence. And in the case that contained a shotgun was all the medication that was stolen.
Now, the newspaper article, the article that Pat Peckham wrote for City Pages, indicated that there were about 800 of these pills in his possession when you busted him. And he claimed that would only last him for a few days, less than 2 weeks. How is that possible?
And I have no basis to, I don't have any personal experience to answer that, but the people I have interviewed reference taking 6 to 8 to 10 80 milligram OxyContin pills a day. And it's tough to understand that. OxyContin is a narcotic, so is morphine, so is methadone, so is Vicodin, but you may only need one 80 milligram OxyContin pill, and you may need 10, 20 milligram Vicodin mm-hmm. pills to get the same effect.
Mitch mentioned in the article that he was taking 40 of these pills a day. And if you figure that 40 of those pills cost $80 a piece on the undercover market, you can see how somebody would turn to armed robbery.
Yeah, I don't think Mitch's addiction was 40 times 80 to come up with his daily cost for narcotics. But if he's taking 40 pills, even at $5 or $10 a piece, it's very hard to see how the average person could afford that type of daily addiction.
Dave, how do you react as somebody who's involved with this and who's been working most of his life in trying to stem the tide of these problems when you hear about cases like Mitch Schmelzer's?
You know, when I first got into law enforcement, I think I thought more that people that would even touch drugs were just bad people, evil people. And the more I've been in it, the longer I've been in it, people get sucked into it. It's a real seductive thing. You know, you try it once, whatever. It's just an experimental thing. It's a party thing, whatever it might be. And all of a sudden, it sucks you in, and before you know it, some of these people who, you know, were fine people, upstanding citizens, whatever, are, you know, addicted beyond what they ever could have dreamed possible. And an important point, I think, is to remember that if you take these drugs, prescription drugs, the way that they're prescribed, they do a great job. They do what they're supposed to do. If you don't take them the way you're supposed to, or we're hearing about some of the people that crush them and snort them, which actually will take away the time release capabilities that the drug, you know, is a part of it, or they're, you know, putting it in water and putting it in a needle and shooting it up, or whatever it might be, putting it in their Mountain Dew and drinking it, whatever it might be, that's not the right way to do it. So the important thing is prescription drugs do work, but you have to be careful, do it the way it's prescribed.
And Matt, you spoke before the Rotary Club in Wausau. You asked the entire group, how many of you have ever taken cocaine? And nary a hand went up. But you asked them, how many of you have taken prescription narcotics?
And they all went up. You know, I think it's important to recognize, and I'll give you my opinion here. I haven't read any scientific studies, but I believe that a certain portion of our population have a personality or something in their genetic makeup that makes them prone to addiction. One person can take a prescribed dose of OxyContin, and when they heal, they can stop. Where another person can take the exact same prescribed dose of OxyContin, and when they heal, they can't. And that's the person that looks back 2 years later and says, I can't believe where my life went.
You hear the same thing about alcoholics. Some people can drink socially, some people can't.
Why can one person go to a casino and spend $50 and lose their $50, which happens to me regularly, and and leave and be happy and have enjoyed yourself, and the other person spends their $50 and can't leave without going to the time machine and draining?
Matt Barnes and Dave Forsyth, we're talking about drug addiction and the law. 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back right after this.
655, the news is next.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include the Door County Visitor Bureau. Featuring a wide range of culinary experiences, Door County offers fish boils, cherries, and 5 wineries, and is home to a variety of restaurants and cooking schools. Travel information at doorcounty.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. We're back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking today about drug abuse in central Wisconsin. We're focusing specifically on OxyContin and prescription narcotics. We'll be talking a bit about methamphetamine in the next half hour. Our guests, Dave Forsyth of the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Matt Barnes, a detective with the Wausau Police Department, telling us just how bad things have become and what we can do about it. 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. If you've got a story you'd like to tell, or a question for either Matt or Dave. We've been talking about prescribing OxyContin, Vicodin. Are the doctors to blame for overprescribing? Is there a problem with our hospital system that these drugs are simply being given too easily, too readily to too many people?
Boy, that's kind of a loaded question. I don't want to get any doctors upset with me, but I have seen and I'm no doctor, be the first one to say that, but I've seen examples where I don't agree with what was taking place. And a great example is a family member of mine needs stitches, and I take him to the emergency room, and a brand new doctor is putting the stitches in, and he's being supervised. And in the end, I had recently been through some drug training. I said, you're going to give him anything for the pain? And his answer was, better living through narcotics. Now, in hindsight, after seeing and learning more about narcotics, that comment scares me, because how many people are going to become addicts if someone's prescribing drugs that way?
Now, and I'm sure that was a joke on his part, but at the same time,
I sure hope so. In preparation for this show, I've done a little research, and I know that different clinics in our area are taking a strong stance toward how they prescribe narcotic medication and creating contracts with their patients when prescribing medication that say, I will obey these rules associated with this use, and if they don't, they can be terminated as patients or not receive that medication.
So maybe if you're prescribed these drugs, maybe you should ask yourself whether or not you should really be taking them, whether it's necessary. And if you've got a leftover prescription, you should certainly not leave it in the medicine cabinet where your kids or their friends can find it.
Absolutely, yeah. Also, what we have a lot of times is people that we call it doctor shopping, where basically they're going from one doctor to another to another to another in pharmacies, and they'll make the circuit of the whole state. And all of a sudden, you know, they come back and they've got, you know, 10 different prescription bottles filled up with whatever it might be, Oxy or whatever. And yeah, I agree with Matt as far as if you go in and say, yeah, my back hurts, and the doctor says, well, here's a prescription, I'm not going to put a lot of blame on doctors, but there are some doctors that need to step up and change some of their practices and make sure that they're digging a little bit deeper and making sure that they should be prescribing those, especially the more seriously, easily addictive ones.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. Katie is calling from her car. Katie, you're on Route 51.
Hi. My question is, when a person receives a prescription for the oxycodone for pain, and I'm very curious because my son, who is a teenager, had his molars pulled and was given that prescription, how quickly can someone become addicted to it? And, you know, what safeguards are there that doctors aren't going to be, refilling prescriptions and actually feeding an addiction?
Matt, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I can try. And I don't have there's no rock solid answer for you as how many days a person has to be on that medication before they can experience withdrawal or have an addiction. I think each person's probably different. I'm glad you asked that question because it leads into the point I wanted to make right before you called, which was, do we blame doctors or do we need to take personal responsibility for our own health care? And so as a parent or as an individual, I'm always asking my physician, do I need this? What happens if I don't have any pain? And, you know, I give you this as an example. Now, I've had my wisdom teeth pulled and that kind of hurt, but I could take that medication for a day. The next day, a Tylenol probably would work. And, you know, we have to say, is feeling a little bit of discomfort or pain a bad thing? How do you know if you're feeling any better if you're taking a medication that never lets you feel pain in the first place?
Katie, do you have a follow-up?
Right.
Did he answer your question?
Yes, and I guess the question is, how do you know that, like, as I'm watching my child, you know, how would I know that he became addicted? What signs or symptoms would there be to know that, we got to make sure to get him, you know, tell him to stop taking this, even though he might feel pain, you know, switch to Tylenol? I don't think a teenager has a good, sense of perspective on, you know, well, the doctor told me to take this, so I'm going to, you know.
Right, right. Doesn't have a lot of life experience to compare things to.
Right.
Katie, thanks so much for the phone call. In fact, we have a drug recognition expert here, Matt Barnes, who looks for the signs of addiction in people. You can look at somebody and pretty much determine what they're on. Is that true?
Well, I'm trained to put people through a series of or an exam, for lack of a better term, and determine whether they're impaired on a drug other than alcohol, and then identify what drug category that is. Kind of to answer your question, though, how do you know when they're addicted? That's a tough question. I think the first step is identifying if they're going through any kind of withdrawal, if there's a period of time when they're not taking that medication, if they get flu-like symptoms or get the chills or the shakes, or really say, come on, let's go get this refilled. You need to take a step back and say, wow, is there a problem? And maybe consult with your physician and express your concerns. And suffer a little bit. Unfortunately, when you break something or they pull a tooth, it's going to hurt.
And keep those lines of communication open with your children. I think that's probably very important. But you can look at somebody, Matt, and pretty much determine what they're on. Isn't that true? Didn't you take a course in that?
Yeah, I did. And it's not to say you took your prescribed dose of a medication. What this program was identified to do is identify impaired drivers. So I can identify when a person is impaired or is not safe to operate a motor vehicle.
How do you know when somebody's on cocaine as opposed to something else?
Well, we're going to put them through their standard sobriety tests. And the first step is, can they pass our sobriety tests? The same ones you'd take in a in an alcohol scenario for driving, a drunk driving. Other things we look for, and for example, a person that's used a stimulant, which cocaine is, most likely is going to have dilated pupils. So we look at their pupil size and we say, is that normal? If it's not, then we continue through the exam. We'll take their pulse. A normal person has a resting pulse of 60 to 90 beats a minute. Mm-hmm. A person high on cocaine might be 140 to 200 beats a minute. And although it's stressful to deal with police officers, we wait a few minutes, and if you have a pulse of 200 beats a minute, you're either going to have a heart attack within the next 10 minutes or you've been taking something.
What about narcotics, heroin or OxyContin? How can you tell by looking at somebody?
It's the opposite of the stimulant effect. We're looking for extremely constricted pupils. We're looking for a slow pulse, shallow breathing, slower respiratory effect. With people that are significantly impaired on narcotics, we see something called on the nod, where they're kind of half awake, half asleep, with droopy eyelids, referred to as ptosis, and they're not with us. They're in kind of half asleep, half awake. And you know, the first clue is the eyes tell us everything. You see constricted pupils. There's nothing else that does that unless you went to the eye doctor and they put drops in your eyes to do that. And we're talking about constricted pupils. When we reduce the light, you know, your eye constricts out in the bright sun. It dilates in the dark. Well, if you have pinned up pupils throughout, the only thing that I'm aware that does that is a narcotic. And if you can't pass simple sobriety tests, divided attention tests, great indicators for us that individual is on that substance.
Matt Barnes and Dave Forsyth, we're talking about drug addiction and the problems it's causing in our central Wisconsin society, the impact on our crime rate. We want to hear from you, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Dave Forsyth of the Wisconsin Department of Justice, Matt Barnes, detective with the Wausau Police Department. We're talking about drug abuse and enforcement, the criminal justice system. We want to hear from you, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go back to the phones. Dave in Wausau, you're on Route 51. Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hey, Glenn, great program. I hear what your experts are saying about addiction. It's interesting that Officer Barnes is talking about recognizing, being trained to recognize people when they're impaired. I think that one of the things I'm missing in the conversation is the treatment of addiction as a disease. I believe addiction, I work in a field where I see people regularly stuck in the revolving criminal door because of their disease, because of their illness. And isn't it sad that sometimes we don't recognize their disease until they are stuck in that door? But my point is, addiction is, I firmly believe, because of my career experience, that addiction is a genetic disease. Now, the officers are trained to recognize an impairment, but unfortunately, none of us are getting the training that we need to recognize addiction in our loved ones, our children, our potential, our spouses, or whatever, at an early age. The previous caller said, how do I tell if my son's addicted? Everybody stuttered on that one, because we don't have the training, and that's the real root of the problem. Focusing on substances, opiates, alcohol, whatever. I know people who are addicted to golf and it's ruining their lives.
I don't disagree with you one bit. There isn't a point you made there that I disagree with. And unfortunately, when my experience is when eyes are open to the addiction and everyone says, boy, there's a problem, there's so much damage that's been done not only to that individual but to their relationships and their families that in a lot of cases there's no turning back. And I'm not sure, I don't know of every resource in the area for someone dealing with addiction to drugs or anything else, but I definitely don't think we're solving the problem with what we have right now.
Dave, I'm going to ask you a question since you called in. Do you think it makes sense to be locking up people for drug problems, for drug abuse?
No, it makes no sense at all. If they're nonviolent offenders and there is a and there's a shot at redemption, or getting them treatment, because coerced treatment, contrary to popular belief, coerced treatment works statistically at about the same rate as voluntary treatment. So I have no qualms with the criminal system finding these people treatment for the first time in their life, and hopefully there's a good outcome in that. My point is, I would like to see the officer's jobs made easier because of a better awareness of addiction in general and society in general. I think we should be teaching it to fifth graders right alongside sex education and education about other diseases.
Dave, what do you do with somebody who's gone through treatment programs and still continues to offend, or somebody who robs a drugstore in order to get OxyContin, or somebody who gets high and goes on the highways and gets into an accident and kills somebody?
Don't we have to
lock people up at some point?
Yeah, no, I'm not arguing against incarceration for somebody who needs to be there to protect me.
I think a lot of times it's those related crimes. I don't think we're naive enough to think that enforcement's going to handle the problem by any means. It's got to be awareness. It has to be a whole multidisciplined approach, working with rehab, working with educators, working, across the board.
Right, and the dialogue about addiction needs to happen.
Sure.
A lot sooner than it is, and that makes your job, my job, and everybody's lives better.
I don't think you can use it as an excuse either, which I see some people do. I'm addicted, so that's why I did this, I did that, I did whatever, all these related crimes, which could be violent crimes and everything else. You're not going to be able to use that.
But then again, making excuses is a classic symptom of a real addiction. it's a catch-22. And,
sure.
You guys do good work, and I honor you guys' work, and keep it up.
Dave, thanks so much for the phone call. Dave Forsyth, in Holland, drugs are legal. They give needles to heroin addicts. They let them destroy their own lives. They let them do it cheaply so they don't have to resort to robbery and violence to fuel those addictions. Why don't we do that here?
Well, I don't necessarily think that experiment has worked real well. I've seen and heard some of the other sides of that, just because that they do the free needles and stuff doesn't mean it's some perfect utopia over there or anything like that. Again, I'm going back to the related crimes. I've talked with so many people that it's a mother that's saved up money for months and months and months, working a couple jobs to get some school clothes for the kids or something like that, and all of a sudden the new boyfriend, husband that's addicted or whatever, comes in. He's tweaking out. He's trying to find where she's got this money hidden. He finds the money. She's crying. That's for the kids. He punches her, takes the money, goes out and get his, $300 worth of crack or meth or whatever it is. That's the stuff that I don't think comes through in some of those statistics, is those related crimes. In Wisconsin, even marijuana is still illegal. And if people don't think it should be so, they need to change those laws. But right now, at least as far as law enforcement's perspective, we're enforcing those laws.
Let me give you a list of famous marijuana users. Paul McCartney of the Beatles, Willie Nelson, comedian Bill Maher, Drew Carey, Jack Nicholson, Jack Black, Brad Pitt, Stephen King, Whitney Houston, Bob Dylan, and politicians who admit they've done it in the past, Newt Gingrich, Al Gore, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Michael Bloomberg. Would society really be better off if we arrested all those people for marijuana and gave them a criminal record?
Oh, dead silence here.
Yeah.
No, I don't think we need to put those people in jail. However, I do think that there are people that function in society and go home and get high every night. I can't argue that point with you. I also know that every drug we've discussed today is an impairing drug, and I drive on the roads with my kids in my vehicle, and if they just smoked a bowl, hop in their car, and are driving on the same roads as me, I'm concerned, because whether they agree or see it or not, they're impaired. Their perception of time and distance is impaired, and I don't want them on the road with me.
I remember the old joke, what's the difference between a drunk driver and a stone driver? A drunk driver goes through red lights. A stone driver stops for green ones. Either one is dangerous.
Absolutely. And sure. Furthermore, we talk about extremes, and without even going to the extreme of the person that's, you say back alley, passed out, stoned in the gutter, I tell you, come for a ride with me and we'll go visit people who are addicted to some of these illicit drugs, a methamphetamine addict, a cocaine addict, someone that needs those 10 narcotic pills a day to function. And they didn't need to get a license to have children. And then let's go look at how that's affecting the home life and how those children are being cared for. And I challenge the person to stand there and say, it's okay. Why do you care what they do?
Dave, let's talk about the kids who grow up in meth labs in those households, because you read about it all the time. Children being raised in home laboratories where there are explosive chemicals. And
right. We call them drug-endangered children. At least in Wisconsin, we have a drug-endangered children alliance or coalition. They have nothing to do with anything. It's not like they're out there trying to score, drugs or anything like that. We've had cases in Wisconsin with infants, that the mother, father, whatever it might be, their caretakers are using methamphetamine, cocaine, whatever it might be. And we've had situations in Wisconsin where they're not even thinking. Again, it's not that the parent hates the child because they love the drug more. It's the whole addiction process and everything else that the addiction to the drug just takes over their whole thought process and everything. So now they're not thinking about the cocaine that got brushed onto the floor and the little infant grabs the pacifier and it gets into some of that and he puts it in his mouth.
Well, those meth labs can blow up.
Oh, there's all kinds of incredible chemicals that are explosive.
Are you getting a handle on the methamphetamine problem?
With the labs, when the pseudoephedrine law went into effect, we saw the labs decrease incredibly. And I know, like in Oklahoma, we patterned our law after theirs a lot. And a year later in Oklahoma, it was down 88%. In Wisconsin, I think our high labs year was 125 or somewhere around there. After the pseudoephedrine law went into effect, it dropped way down to about a third that, I think. And last year, I think we were somewhere around 12 labs, something like that. The thing is, it started that appetite for methamphetamine, and people, the Mexican drug trafficking organizations picked up the slack where the labs have gone away.
Somebody will, if there's a demand, somebody will find a way to supply
Absolutely.
It.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We have time for one more caller. Ron in Wausau, you're on Route 51. Hello, Ron.
Hi there. Hi, Matt, Dave, this is Ron.
Hey, Ron.
I am calling, I guess, and Dave started touching on it a little bit, in regards to some of the effects that aren't glaringly apparent, and the kids are one of them. But the other thing that I think gets lost a little bit when you talk about drug addiction in society is the cost to everybody else, and that is in lost productivity at the workplace, increased health care costs, increased insurance costs, the dangers and the hazards of other offenses and other crimes like child abuse, spousal abuse, all sorts of different things that sometimes don't get brought out because it's not a headline news. It's not somebody pointing a gun at somebody to get a narcotic from a drugstore or from an individual. And so I think the dangers and the hazards go on, long past some of the headline news items.
Absolutely, I agree. And I touched on it as far as the related crimes and the related costs, and you put it well, I think.
Ron, thanks so much for the phone call. We do have to wrap things up. We're almost out of time. Just very quickly, how does this affect you personally, this line of work dealing with people who have been affected by these chemicals and who are on the outside of society? And a lot of them certainly don't want your intervention and help.
It's interesting because I grab hold of those bright spots, those people that actually came through addiction, came through using a lot. They came out the other side, and they're actually good, productive, decent people, members of society. That keeps me going, and also just to see the people that are involved. Sometimes I feel like a cheerleader for the agents that are out there working their butts off. And then you see what happens in the court system, where you see the people keep going through, on and on and on, going through rehab however many times, on and on and on.
Pat Barnes?
For me, you kind of hold on to your last success. And for every individual you arrest and take to jail because they did something bad, for whatever the reason, addiction or otherwise, when you have a positive outcome, you also have victims who, it's amazing the level of appreciation you get from those individuals. So to go home at the end of the day, even if it's just one out of every 10 days, knowing someone said thank you and they meant it and you've made their life better or made it safer, you know, that's a great thing to take home with you.
Let's hope that both of you have many more successes. Dave Forsyth, Matt Barnes, thanks for being with us. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next Thursday on Route 51, our guest is Mort McBain, who recently retired as Marathon County Administrator, where he presided for years over a board of supervisors consisting of 38 individuals, many with different backgrounds and political agendas. We'll talk to Mort about how he forged a consensus among those diverse interests, about the changing economic and political landscape of central Wisconsin, and about his life story as a Vietnam veteran, artist, and leader with the Mormon Church. Thanks to our executive producer and on-air producer, Rick Ryer. Thanks to all of you who called in with your comments and questions. And thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Thanks to all of you for riding along with us. Until next week, we're heading out of town.